Hello, everyone. I guess I want to begin by really congratulating Alessandra and Mariano for putting together such an innovative and exciting event today. So the idea of a theatrical laboratory that brings together discussion and performance, history and live demonstration seems to me like the ideal forum in which to consider as beguiling a subject as mesmerism. So in my paper today, building on Mariano's discussion of animal magnetism and mesmerism, I'm going to be similarly concerned with the kind of blurred boundaries between natural wonder and magic trick, stage show and medical experiment. So I have come down from the University of Strathclyde, where I teach mostly in the history of medicine, with a focus on the history of psychology and psychiatry. And in terms of my own research, I've worked on a quite diverse range of topics in British history, predominantly in the 19th and 20th century. But broadly speaking, my focus tends to lie, or my interest tends to lie, with the zones in between discrete fields of knowledge. So my interest normally lies in with investigating kind of how marginal discourses impact upon what kind of knowledge eventually becomes mainstream. So my interest is with, I guess, what could be described as moments of contestation, in which medical and scientific questions are taken up and answered by a diverse range of voices. So where illegitimate forms of knowledge, the supernatural, the folkloric, the popular, say, come to shape the kinds of discourse that become validated and valued as authoritative in the public realm. So to give you some solid examples, just now I'm working on a project that examines the relationship between psychoanalysis and popular occultism in the interwar period. And I have a book coming out next month which explores how folkloric understandings of vision came to shape the Victorian scientific imaginary. So my paper today, which is titled Hypnotism, Criminal Suggestion and Medical Experimentation, addresses some of the same questions asked by these projects. So specifically, it looks at one particularly fraught moment of contestation in the history of hypnotism, involving a Parisian legal scandal, several famous French neurologists, a wandering somnambulist, and a series of rather ethically dubious experiments. So my concern here is with the history of hypnotism rather than with mesmerism, but I want to follow Mariano in thinking about the overlaps between therapeutic practice and entertainment, my aim broadly being to consider some of the ways in which hypnotism was staged in the public realm. So I want to begin, though, in the cinema. So fans of early film will recognise this as a still from that classic of 1920s expressionism, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. The silent film tells the story of a hypnotist who uses his masterful powers of persuasion to make a sleepwalker commit murders at his behest. The story takes place in the village of Holstenval, a shadowy place of twisted buildings and dark corners. Here, two friends decide to pay a visit to the town fair, where they come across a sideshow attraction featuring Caligari and his spectacular sleepwalker. Lying in a coffin-like wooden box, on command, the sleepwalker awakens to predict the fortunes of the gathered audience. One of the two friends asks for a prediction for how long he will live, only to be told, to his horror, that he will not survive to see the morning. Sure enough, later that night, a dark figure breaks into the ill-fated man's apartment and stabs him to death. The crime is followed by another attempted murder and a botched kidnapping, after which the somnambulist is revealed to have been carrying out the murderous desires of his hypnotic captor, who in turn, in another twist, is revealed to be the head of the local insane asylum. A diary discovered in the office of the psychiatrist exposes the terrible truth. In an entry written after the admission of a special new patient, Caligari has scrawled a jubilant epitaph. "Now," he writes, "I shall solve the psychiatric riddle. Now I shall fathom whether it is true or not that a somnambulist may be forced to commit acts that he would never commit in a waking state, that indeed he would loathe." So here the audience is confronted with a disquieting vision of medical authority run riot, of extreme and inhumane experiments conducted in the name of psychiatric knowledge. In the film, the multi-layered narratives and shifting perspectives employed allow the audience no comfortable position, We may want to dismiss the story as the ravings of a madman, but the film's power lies with the glimmers of recognition it inspires. Like all good monsters, the murderous somnambulist provokes not only fear and disgust, but more worryingly, a kind of identification. What the sleepwalker seems to reveal to us are the limits of our own conscious intentions, that the control we imagine ourselves to possess over our own thoughts, our behaviours, and our actions might not be absolute. This dark fantasy forces us to question the assumptions of rationalism and individualism, free will and agency that undergird our sense of autonomous selfhood. If we are not in control of ourselves, who or what is? So released in 1919, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari contributed to a popular fascination with the murkier possibilities of hypnotism, and specifically to what I would describe as a kind of cultural obsession with the disquieting prospect of criminal suggestion. The sad fate of the somnambulist, induced to commit terrible acts by the dominating will of another, engaged an audience that was already well attuned to the questions of automaticity and volition, perception and consciousness raised by the practice of hypnotism. So the figure of the malevolent hypnotist lurks in the theatre, film and literature of the early 20th century. And here on the screen are just a couple of examples. So the image, which I think is on the... Oh, now I can't see from this perspective. This one here. This image is from a still from a 1913 film called The Other, in which a respected lawyer survives a horse riding accident only to discover that he has developed a split personality. So a normal waking self and a kind of alternate nighttime self who commits crimes without his knowledge. And the other image is from a poster from a 1922 film, which was directed by Fritz Lang, called Dr. Mabuse the Gambler, which follows the nefarious career of its title character, a criminal mastermind, a doctor of psychology, and an adept hypnotist, as he cheats and murders his way through the Berlin underground. Elsewhere, in cheap novels with titles like The Slave of His Will, In His Grasp, and Hypnotized, A Doctor's Confession, hypnotism circulated in this period within the popular imaginary as a morally questionable and potentially criminal enterprise, a public reputation that proved increasingly problematic for those attempting to establish its therapeutic value and its medical possibilities. So, though painted in the lurid colours of a stage show villain, the figure of Dr. Caligari was drawn, at least in part, from real life. Since the late 19th century, neurologists and psychiatrists in Britain and in Europe had been engaged by the question of criminal suggestion. Papers had been written, positions staked out, and arguments formulated. Respected men of science had put their reputations on the line, and colleagues quarrelled over the fundamental truths that may not be revealed. Could, for example, a hypnotised person be made to commit murder? Can individuals be transformed into automatons, obeying the hypnotist's every instruction, or was there some essential aspect of the self, some immutable agency, that prevents one from committing crimes oppositional to one's nature? And, like the malevolent Dr. Caligari, medical men working at several different institutions undertook experiments that aimed to settle these questions. So using wooden daggers, blank bullets, and pretend poisons, medical investigators staged hypnotic crimes using their patients as actors. The results of these trials were printed in respected publications like The Lancet and the BMJ, and through the closing years of the 19th century, they remained central to debates over the nature and medical efficacy of hypnotism. Earlier in the century, those engaged by the qualities of animal magnetism and mesmerism had also conducted trials in which patients were induced to commit immoral acts while in a disassociated state. So to blaspheme, for example, to insult loved ones, to steal, and so on. What I think distinguishes this later period of investigation is that it took place alongside and contributed to broader debates over the possibility of hypnotic crime, which were being undertaken by the legal community also. After all, if it was true, that individuals could be forced to commit criminal acts against their will, then where would the legal responsibility for that act lie? These medical legal conundrums took on some urgency in the 1880s and 1890s after several well-publicized court cases in which both victims and defendants claimed to have fallen prey to the machinations of villains gifted with hypnotic powers. So I plan to circle back around to the courtroom towards the end of this talk, but I want to turn first to a particularly important figure in this history. And now I come to the portion of my talk where I have to say a number of French names, and I'm really aware that I'm surrounded by a modern languages group, so apologies for my terrible pronunciation, just straight off the bat. Okay. So I'm going to turn to a particularly important figure in this history, the French physician Ambroise Auguste Le Beau, maybe? Hopefully, who's pictured here. He's the kind of one glowering in the corner with a group of recuperating patients. So Le Beau, having happened across a book on animal magnetism as a young student, when he set up his first medical practice in a small French town, Le Beau decided to use techniques and methods that had been gleaned from the old mesmerizers to minister to his patients. So finding that mild psychological disorders, as well as neuralgias, ulcers, menstrual cramps, and also rheumatism, seemed to respond well to suggestion, Le Beau began offering free hypnotic treatment to some of his poorer patients and publishing his results. Dismissed as a quack and a fool for most of his career, Le Beau's unusual clinic eventually attracted the attention of the famous neurologist Hippolyte Bernheim, who recognized him as a pioneer in the field of hypnotherapy. And the pair soon went on to found one of the most significant centers for research into hypnotism, the Nancy School. So in addition to treating a wide variety of nervous complaints through the 1880s, the school, the Nancy School, also played host to a series of carefully staged hypnotic crimes. So the results of these experiments were published in several books and pamphlets, which described remarkable cases of patients who seemed to have been induced by the power of suggestion to commit heinous and reckless acts. So while in a trance-like state, a girl fires a revolver that she has been told is loaded at a local magistrate. Another commits a theft in the home of a fellow patient, only to come and return the stolen goods later. A man dissolves a powder, which he has been told is arsenic, into a glass of water and gives it willingly to his aunt. In one account, Le Beau described how having, and I quote, entirely mastered the will of a young female patient, he was able to cause her to fall into a violent rage with a friend, to fly upon her with a knife in her hand. Having displaced in her mind the sentiment of friendship, still armed with that instrument, I sent her to stab her best friend, whom I told her she saw in front of her. She obeyed, the knife burying itself in the wall opposite. So, seemingly transformed, however briefly, into murderous automatons, following the execution of these crimes, the entranced perpetrators seemed to remember nothing of what had occurred. More troubling still, Le Beau postulated that it might be possible to plant the idea to commit a criminal action in the mind of a hypnotized person, have them awaken and return to normal life, only to commit the act later, leaving open the rather chilling possibility that, and I quote from Le Beau here, the poor dreamer, unmindful of the primary incitement to the criminal action, would commit personal vengeance on another's account instead of on his own. Often, however, these experiments fell flat, with patients proving unwilling to steal or to maim their loved ones. And Bernheim himself was careful to emphasize that not everyone could be hypnotized into committing a crime. So success being far more likely with subjects who lacked a strong moral character, were naturally impulsive, or perhaps suffered from conditions like epilepsy or hysteria. So, though undertaken with a serious purpose in mind, there was admittedly something faintly ridiculous in the image of a hospital overrun by patients wielding wooden daggers and pretend guns. And the bumptious theatricality of these experiments drew harsh criticism from other medical advocates of hypnotism, who accused the Nancy School of bringing their practice into disrepute. The staging of Hypnotic Crimes was, according to their detractors, problematic in several respects. So firstly, if accepted, the results of these experiments would seem to confirm the public image of the hypnotist as a manipulative and immoral character, and of hypnotism itself as dangerous and potentially degrading to the individual. Secondly, and relatedly, these experiments threatened to further muddy the waters between hypnotism as a therapeutic practice and hypnotism as a popular entertainment. So having been introduced to the medical community in the 1840s by the Scots physician James Braid, hypnotism had long existed in uncomfortable proximity with the magnetic treatments offered by lay healers, the trance states being cultivated by spiritualist mediums, and the stage performances of travelling mesmerists. Given this history, the performative flair of staged murders and play-acted robberies orchestrated by a team of doctor directors would do little to convince the mainstream scientific community of the legitimacy of hypnotism as a tool of medicine. And finally, all these concerns aside, the results of these experiments were, according to their critics, wholly invalid anyway, because it seemed likely that the patients themselves were able to distinguish between real and invented crimes. Rather than automatons, patients were actors in arranged dramas, acted out for the pleasure of their doctors, who, in their arrogance, had mistaken stage performances for medical facts. The problem, in short, according to critics, was that because of the illegality of exhorting a real hypnotic crime, having a patient really use a real knife or really shoot a loaded gun, say, the Nancy School experiments could never be, in the words of one critic, more than mere parlour room entertainments. So Bernheim's response to these criticisms, I think, is quite significant. So rather than deny the theatricality of the staged hypnotic crime, he allowed that hypnotized persons might conceive of themselves as performing the suggested actions only to please the hypnotist. But he insisted that this freedom to choose was in itself an illusion. So he explained that, and I quote, "There are many persons who imagine that they were under nobody's influence, because they remember hearing everything, they truly believe that they were stimulating, and it is sometimes difficult to convince them that they did not possess the freedom not to simulate." So in other words, if a patient play acts because they cannot resist play acting, then where does the agency behind those actions reside? So more than a psychiatric pantomime, the Nancy School experiments constituted, I think, a highly controversial inquiry into the nature of individual liberty and unconscious mental activity. Importantly, they also marked an attempt to define and validate one understanding of a hypnotic action over competing accounts. So specifically, the fake crimes staged by Bernheim and LeBeau exposed a fault line between two opposing schools of psychiatry, the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris and the Nancy School. So in Paris, the neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot developed hypnosis as a clinical technique used in the treatment of that grandest of female maladies, hysteria. Grounded in the science of neurophysiology, he attributed hysteria to a morbid organization of the nervous system and noted similarities between its symptoms and the kind of disassociated state that could be induced by hypnotism. Attributing it to the same hereditary weakness, for Charcot, hypnosis was a diagnostic feature of hysteria. So both were conditions of the nerves, both were abnormal states of mind, and one followed the other. So that to be suggestible, to be open to being hypnotized, was by definition to be hysterical. So this pathological reading was contested by Bernheim and his followers, who argued that no direct correlative relation existed between nervous degeneracy and hypnosis. And who they insisted instead that suggestibility was a normal human trait, and that anyone really could be hypnotized. So as evangelists for the therapeutic potentials of hypnotism, psychiatrists and neurologists at the Nancy School undertook clinical studies geared towards demonstrating the universality of hypnotic influence. So where suggestibility at the Salpêtrière was confined to the hysterical patient, the vision of hypnotism explicated by the Nancy School was a rather more ambiguous proposition. So the practice was, they insisted, of great therapeutic potential, but as their experiments with criminal suggestion also indicated, it was a practice that was also open to terrible misappropriation and misuse. So in 1890, the rivalry between these two teaching hospitals came to a head over the course of a highly publicized murder trial. In what came to be known in Britain as the case of the bloody trunk, a young woman named Gabrielle Bompard was accused along with a male accomplice, Michel Arond, of the murder and robbery of a Parisian bailiff named Gouff. So planning to rob, so the facts of the case were largely uncontested. Planning to rob a wealthy acquaintance, the pair had purchased his trunk large enough to hold a body and rigged up a rather gruesome hanging apparatus in Bompard's apartment. The unsuspecting Gouff was then lured to the apartment with the promise of a sexual liaison. And once there, Bompard settled him on a chair and playfully wrapped a cord around his neck, a cord from her dressing gown around his neck. Springing from behind the curtain, Arond caught the cord and attached it to a pulley system and prepared to hang Gouff. At that moment, something went wrong. It is possible that the beam collapsed or that Gouff just struggled so much that their kind of elegantly constructed apparatus was of no use. But either way, Arond was forced to strangle his victim by hand before stuffing his body into the waiting trunk. Finding then that poor Gouff wasn't even carrying any cash for them to steal, the pair made for Lyon, transporting the trunk and eventually disposing of it with little success, as the body was soon discovered by authorities and an investigation launched. So, featuring a grisly murder, a femme fatale, and midnight flits, the case was already primed to be a tabloid sensation when Bompard's lawyer launched an unusual defence. His client, he claimed, had been acting under the influence of post-hypnotic suggestion. And he called Jules Lechois, it's a terrible French, the professor of law at the Nancy School and a disciple of Bernheim, as an expert witness. On the stand, Lechois insisted that anyone with an impressionable nature could be prevailed upon to act unconsciously under the influence of external suggestion, and that as such, the defendant could not be held responsible for the crime with which she was charged. In response, the prosecution had a team of psychiatrists loyal to Charcot examine Bompard. They concluded that though she displayed some hysteric traits, these were certainly not so severe as to affect her judgment, and that the cause of her criminal behaviour lay in the viciousness of her character rather than any external factors. So debate in court revolved around the psychological and physiological nature of hypnosis, with each side fighting to establish their own medical legal authority. But in the end, the Parisians won the day, with Bompard found guilty and sentenced to 20 years hard labour. And Lechois was also widely pilloried in the medical and mainstream press. One of the most outspoken critics of the Nancy School's methods was the neurologist Gilles de la Tourette, who published a series of gloating articles mocking Bernheim and Lebeau's obsession with hypnotic crime. Yet the verdict in the Bompard case did not cool public interest in questions of criminal suggestion. And in fact, just 3 years later, Tourette would find himself at the centre of another media sensation. In December of 1893, he returned home to find a young woman, whom he recognised as a former patient of his, waiting for him. When he arrived, she told him that she had been hypnotised many times and that she felt that she had lost herself because of these treatments and was now unable to work. When he refused to help her and turned towards his front door, she shot him twice in the head. The wound was not severe, and Tourette recovered, but attention was soon drawn to his attacker's strange motivations. In her confession, she told the police that she had been hypnotised without her consent, and that as a consequence, her own will had been completely annihilated. She said that there had been another person in her that had urged her to shoot Tourette. But more sensational still was the rumour that began to circulate in medical circles and in the popular press that not only had the crime been committed in a somnambulistic state, but that it had been done so under the control of a rival neurologist, possibly Bernheim, who wished to demonstrate to the sceptical Tourette that hypnotic criminal suggestion was not only possible, but was in fact a very real threat. So I just want to conclude briefly, as I'm running over, by suggesting that we can think about the story that grew up around Tourette's unfortunate encounter as being kind of typical of how hypnotism was staged in popular culture in this period. So despite attempts to contain the meaning of this incident by dismissing Tourette's attacker as delusional, as hysteric, as attention-seeking, it proved impossible to control its circulation. Instead, the legend that grew up around this assassination attempt told of warring neurologists, of wandering somnambulists, and of the terrible power of suggestion. A sensationalist narrative that arguably frustrated attempts to inaugurate hypnotism as a legitimate medical practice. So there is a familiar story that we could tell about the slippages between the scientific and the popular, between official and unofficial knowledge. But what I think is really interesting about this episode in the history of French psychiatry is the way that the Nancy School really quite consciously appropriated the tools and tropes of the theatre in their experiments with criminal suggestion. So these were moments of contestation, certainly, where therapeutic legitimacy and the public image of hypnotism were certainly at stake. But I think that these trials also reveal something of the codependency of the medical and the popular in defining the shape of this particular discourse. So rather than strictly demarcate the legitimate from the illegitimate, from science from entertainment, fact from rumour, Dr. Caligari from Dr. Bernheim, it might be more useful to think about the different and interconnected ways that hypnotism was staged in public culture. Thanks.